Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll be joined by Alex Zaychik, who spent several months on the road talking to Donald Trump supporters. What he discovered might surprise you, or it might not. We'll see. Then we'll be joined by Christy Siegfried. Christy is Erin News Migration Editor, and she'll tell us about the ongoing crisis of gang violence in Central America and why the fact that it's not considered a traditional armed conflict makes it a hellish environment for aid workers. There's a lot of need for humanitarian assistance. There isn't a lot of resources, and there are all sorts of obstacles. Finally, we're going to go back to the archives for one of my favorite interviews with Paul Piff. He's a professor of psychology at UC Irvine, and his work shows that the wealthy really are different than you and I, and maybe we should be happy about that. But first, a couple of items you may have missed. On Friday, a federal appeals court blocked voter ID laws in Kansas, Alabama, and Georgia, dealing a blow to Republican efforts to disenfranchise groups that tend to skew toward Democrats. It's a preliminary injunction, but the court ruled that the plaintiffs, the League of Women Voters, was likely to win on the merits when the case comes to fruition. You may have heard about these Blue Lives Matter laws. They classify various crimes against police and other first responders as hate crimes. They are transparent gimmicks because all states levy stiffer penalties for violence against law enforcement officers. Anyway, Louisiana arrested the first person under its new Blue Lives Matter law. The guy was drunk and disorderly, and he cursed at police officers. Now, he didn't assault them, he didn't stab them, he didn't shoot them, he insulted them. Now, granted, what he said was pretty nasty. It was too vile to repeat on this show, but you know what? The First Amendment guarantees the right to insult the police. It may not be a smart idea, it may not be a polite thing to do, but it is a constitutionally guaranteed right, and this case is definitely going to get thrown out. I mean, not the drunken disorderly charges, obviously, but the Blue Lives Matter hate crime charge is going to get thrown out. North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un has banned the use of sarcasm in his isolated country. According to The Independent, and I quote, officials told people that sarcastic expressions such as "this is all America's fault" would constitute unacceptable criticism of the regime. End quote. Apparently, Kim Jong-un figured out that people only disagree with him ironically. Finally, Donald Trump, the man who called most Mexicans rapists, said Muslims are all over New Jersey, danced a jig after 9/11, claimed an Indiana-born judge was too darn Mexican to be impartial, questioned the loyalty of the parents of a dead war hero, is demanding an apology from Hillary Clinton for saying that around half of his supporters represent a quote-unquote basket of deplorables. Basket of deplorables. It is kind of an odd phrase, basket of deplorables. Lots of hand-wringing over this one, including from some on the left. And you know what? She shouldn't have said it because it's probably no more than 40 or 45%. Probably no more than 40 or 45% actually are in the basket of deplorables. Anyway, it is a little ironic to see the anti-PC crowd demanding a safe space. Maybe next time she uses the line on the stump, she'll preface it with a trigger warning. Let's move along with the show. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Alex Zaychik. Stay tuned.
Others lust for a temptress. Well, I don't need one of those, 'cause my love is you. My love is you. Some men replace their mamas and some want a young boy out of nowhere. I got no use for those, 'cause my love is you.
Welcome back. I'm joined now by Alex Zajcik. Alex spent months traveling through Appalachia, the Rust Belt, the border region, talking to Trump supporters, and he wrote a book about it. It's called The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America, and it is available from Skyhorse Hot Books. Alex Zajcik, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I actually think the last time you were on the show, it was still called the Alternate Radio Hour, but same difference. Listeners know that I'm big on disclosure when I interview authors, and while it looks super interesting, I have not had a chance to read Alex's books yet. It's on my list, but this is the busy season. Alex, great timely idea. Let's just start with a little overview of your journey. How long were you on the road? Where did you go exactly?
Well, I jumped on in early March in the run-up to the Arizona vote, and I stayed on the road through mid-June. So altogether, it was about 3.5 months. I was focused on the three areas you mentioned in the states of Arizona, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, West Virginia, New Mexico, and California. So I sort of followed the primary calendar, you know, but not necessarily in the same way that the beat reporters did. I tended to hang out in the state a little bit longer, both before and after the actual vote. And I tried to get off the event kind of beat, you know, not just going to rallies, but really traveling around the state.
It strikes me that there's something vaguely like anthropological about this project. Like, did you encounter any hostility or suspicion as a youngish journalist from New York City?
Yeah, a little bit. But I generally am able to overcome that with time and in many cases a little bit of lubrication. I hung out in a lot of bars. As for anthropology, I suppose, but the inspiration for the idea was really the most unacademic person in journalism I can think of, which is Studs Terkel. Terkel, of course, is the Chicago journalist, radio host, who basically founded oral history in this country with his books like Working and The Good War and books about the Depression, where he basically just did long form biographical interviews with everyday Americans and did not interject himself very much at all in those interviews and just kind of presented raw, slightly edited transcripts in his books. And that was kind of the idea, was to really give people the chance to present themselves in full as opposed to sound bites, and kind of get at politics through a back door by sort of presenting a fuller figure that you can kind of circle around from 360 degrees and kind of examine and try to see what's really going on here with these people that flocked to Trump in the primaries.
Now, why don't you give us a sense of a few of the people who you talked to that provided like more revealing or unexpected angles of Trump support, maybe?
Yeah, I encountered a lot of surprises along the way. Some people were not that surprising. They sort of conformed to some of the stuff you get on TV with the sensationalist footage of violence at rallies and, you know, very in-your-face kind of people screaming about Muslims and Mexicans. But I have to say they were the minority. And the people I talked to included very thoughtful sensitive folks. There's a guy in Arizona named Anthony Holston, who's sort of the first profile presented in the book. He was a veteran from Iraq and Afghanistan. So was his brother. His brother committed suicide upon his return. Holston himself attempted suicide several times and was very bitter about being sent to fight these wars that he considered, you know, on false pretenses as well as for the purposes of making people like Dick Cheney wealthy. He was very bitter about John McCain and the handling of the VA system, which he considered dysfunctional and underfunded. So he really resonated with Trump's critiques of both the Bush family and John McCain, which, of course, a lot of pundits thought was the death knell of Trump's candidacy. For people like Holston, you know, sort of working class vets in Arizona, and he's involved in a couple efforts to provide housing for homeless vets, of which there are many. You know, this guy is not someone who you would sort of think of as the sort of obvious Trump voter. His girlfriend had some Mexican heritage. Her name was Garcia. He had a lot of sympathy, empathy even, for, you know, undocumented migrant workers. And I just spent a lot of time with him at his local bar, which was basically a vet biker's bar. There was a guy in West Virginia named Ed Wiley who campaigned against coal plants that were threatening local elementary schools, mostly very low income communities. So he was basically technically an environmental justice activist. Very, very smart guy, very anti-coal guy, wanted something better for his community of Raleigh County in the center of coal county, coal country, West Virginia. And often I'd talk to these people and I'd say, how can you support this man? I mean, you obviously have more of an understanding of the kind of complexity of these issues than he's blathering on about and ranting about, and you're an intelligent human being and an empathic one. What's the connection? And often they'll say, look, we've tried everything. We are ready to roll the dice on this guy. We don't like everything he has to say. We certainly don't take everything he has to say that seriously or literally. But he is coming from outside, and he is presenting some kind of anger that we can relate to. And the fact that he's, you know, we look at who he's angering the most, these elites, and, you know, he's pissing off the right people. So that counted for a lot with a lot of these people. And for the most part, the people I spoke to were very clear in their anger and resentment being directed upward as opposed to downward. So I don't know if it's really the sort of anti-immigrant backlash politics that it can seem like when you just focus on the Trump campaign and the things coming out of his mouth and the response he gets at these rallies. Because when you scratch the surface, as I tried to do, and I should say I did not talk to 13 million people
right,
who supported him. So it's a multitude.
Yeah.
And I don't want to replace one false stereotype with another. I was simply struck by the complexity that I often encountered in the Trump base, which kind of muddied the picture that I started out with and was perfectly willing to have reinforced. When I covered the Tea Party in 2010, I would say the stereotypes that I had were mostly reinforced. That was a more kind of middle-class movement where I was reporting on it in Orlando and Central Florida mostly. And I was focused more on very depressed communities in this book. So that maybe self-selected the people I spoke with a little bit. But for the most part, I think people were very conscious of keeping their anger focused upward and not downward.
It's hard for me to reconcile this with the fact that he is someone who always touts the fact that he is a billionaire, that he is, you know, he buys and sells politicians. The nature of his campaign, which is to punch both upward and downward, right? It's classic right populist campaign where you say there's rot at the top, there's corruption at the top, and then there's predation from below. We're being raped and murdered by Mexican immigrants, etc., etc. And I wonder what role the celebrity figure of Trump plays, right? I mean, he had a top-rated television show for 7 years. It was a quote-unquote reality show, even though we know these things are tightly scripted. Viewers got the sense that they knew this guy in their living room. Did you get any sense that they were willing to believe some of this stuff and also suspend their beliefs about some of the things he was saying because they felt they knew him in a different way?
Yeah, the entertainment aspect of all this is a big part of it, I think. And the people just find the guy funny and relatable and some sort of every guy kind of sort of like an Andrew Dice Clay appeal, which is a point Dave Eggers made in a piece he wrote for The Guardian a couple months ago, which I think was a good point. Kind of this outer borough funny guy. But you have this permeation of entertainment values and this coarsening of the culture that Trump represents that's been this steady kind of process for decades. And, you know, some of the touchstones for what led us to Trump, I think, might be, Daniel Borstein's The Pseudo Event, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman's book. I mean, I think that's kind of like deep, deep history to Trump's rise, partly. But as for the fact that he himself represents this kind of, 1% class, and how could he be someone to avenge the average American and the working man, people kind of hope that he's some sort of very crude version of FDR. Someone actually used that example in a conversation. I was kind of shocked, but they see him as this potential class traitor, coming out of immense wealth. And maybe they don't like his braggart approach to it because that's often against the kind of values they grew up with. But they say, hey, you know, he's got the, this is what allowed him to come in from the outside and whack these people. If he didn't have that kind of money and he didn't, you know, come up through the ranks and know how to build businesses and have TV shows, then he wouldn't be able to do this. So, you know, let's roll the dice. And again, for a lot of these people, it is a roll of the dice. They're like kind of feeling out of options and they're like, let's see what happens. It's worth a shot. Look where we are. I mean, it's been a steady deterioration for decades. And, you know, I hate to quote Donald Trump. I mean, it's not in the same context, but the sort of what do we have to lose thing does come into play with a lot of these people.
That's interesting. And it sounds like they are trying to avoid a degree of dissonance when you have a girlfriend who's Mexican-American, or did you say Hispanic, Latino? I don't remember.
She had a little bit of Mexican.
Okay. So, you know, and you see this guy talking about these people in the crudest terms. There has to be an attempt to kind of reconcile this. It must be somewhat difficult cognitively. Let me ask you this. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Alex Zajcik about his new book, which is called The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. It's out now from Skyhorse Hot Books. So in the kind of media, in our great media debates, there's a lot of discussion. Are they motivated by racial animus or economic insecurity? And I find that there's a false dichotomy here, right? I mean, why do so many people assume that you can't be full of racial animus and also profoundly economically insecure intuitively? And there is some research that captures this in terms of immigration specifically. But intuitively, one would think that members of a majority group would be more likely to seek others to scapegoat, you know, whether that's people of color or immigrants, liberals, whatever, if their own lives suck, right? If things are going great, then why resent that guy over there? Yeah. But now you told Chris Hayes that if you had to choose, again, it's a false dichotomy, but you told Chris Hayes that if you had to choose, you'd say they were more motivated by economic issues than racial animus. Unpack that for me.
Right. Well, to repeat your very important point yet a third time, it is a false dichotomy, and it's very difficult when you're on TV and you have a 20-second time box to try to talk about that.
Yes.
But the reason why I said if I had to choose is because I gave all of these people I spoke to, probably more than 100 in total. I didn't talk to anyone besides a Trump supporter on the road. That was one of my rules for this project, other than the people I was crashing with. I gave them a chance to choose in our conversations. And again and again and again, the first things out of their mouth had to do with the fact that the jobs they grew up with are now replaced by service jobs that don't pay anywhere near as well. That the energy jobs they grew up with are now deunionized and pay less. And that people in their communities were on heroin because there were no jobs. And then the conversation could bleed into, you know, we shouldn't be spending all this money on illegal immigrants going to the state college system. We shouldn't be, you know, that social, racial stuff would kind of bleed in, but it never started there in my experience with most of these people. And, you know, I gave people plenty of time to kind of reveal themselves and their priorities. And at the end of it, if you present me with that dichotomy, which again is way too oversimplified, I would have to come down on that side. And a lot of people I've spoken with kind of don't want to believe that that was my experience. It's been very kind of controversial with a lot of people I know. They're like, well, you obviously weren't paying attention. You're delusional. You don't know what racism looks like. I'm like, well, actually, I do. I've spent most of my career covering conservative and far-right movements here and around the world, including a stint with the Southern Poverty Law Center, where I was focused very narrowly on these groups, these professional racist groups that now we're calling the alt-right. So I think I can detect racism when I see it. And I did see it, and I don't deny that. But it was usually the minor key. And the two are interrelated, as you said. I don't think the Trump phenomenon is reducible to racism. And as you implied, racism in this country is not reducible to racism in many cases. It's part of a larger social system, and it can be manipulated, inflamed, stoked when you have more people chasing an ever smaller piece of the pie. And that's what we're seeing in this country. And we're seeing economic and kind of spiritual impoverishment and pain lead to prejudice and reinforce each other. And, you know, it projects itself. But I don't think we have to deny one versus the other. And, you know, we have to be honest about the full picture here. And it is very complex. and worthy of a lot more thought than I think we're giving it now that everyone's in this kind of gladiatorial election mode.
Yeah, and that is the way it is when you're in a general election. I think that that's kind of natural and to be expected to some degree. But let me just talk to you about some research that Sean McElwee and Jason McDaniels did. They wrote a piece about it in Salon. It was titled Anatomy of a Donald Trump Supporter, What Really Motivates This Terrifying Political Movement. And apologies for the Salon headline, of course. It's like an alternate headline, right?
Yeah.
But they ran data, right, from the American National Election Studies database, which is a huge collection of lots of survey data. This was the pilot 2016 database. And what they found was that there were statistically significant differences between Trump supporters and not only the population as a whole, but also backers of other candidates in the Republican primaries. Again, they wrote this before the primaries were completed, late in the process, but before they were completed. And what they found was that Trump's backers had a more negative view of Hispanics, Blacks, Muslims, feminists, transgender people, and also the larger LGBT community. So this is statistically significant differences between them and the public at large, and also supporters of, at this point, I believe Rubio had dropped out and it was Kasich and Cruz. You think of Cruz as a very hard right guy. They also had a warmer view. These are based on questions that have these thermometer questions. Do you feel warm or cool? A warmer view toward white people, which is also statistically significant. So how do we reconcile this kind of empirical data with what you're telling us about your extensive experience talking to many, many, not just a few people, but a fairly large sample. What do you think? How can we square that circle?
Well, I mean, I don't make as grand a claims as this study. I didn't hand out cards to people. I didn't run, you know, tests on them to, like, you know, biometric tests of their
right.
reaction to certain images of different racial groups. All I did was talk to people and hang out with them and tried to give them a chance to talk about what mattered to them. And all I can do is stand by my much more limited reporting, which has very minimalist claims. It actually has very few claims. I'm just kind of presenting it in this book the way, you know, not to draw any equivalency at all, but the way Terkel just kind of recorded these American stories and put them in a book and let people kind of draw their own conclusions.
No, I didn't mean to put you on the spot with that question. I was actually thinking about
I struggle with this myself. I wrestle with it. I mean, I know about these studies and I see the same image as everyone else. And I know that there's ugliness out there. I encountered it. Absolutely. But I also can't pretend like I didn't meet these other people and I just met them again and again. And I don't know how to explain it. I really don't.
I will throw out a thought though. You mentioned that you were visiting some really economically depressed communities.
Yeah.
And these studies are looking at Republican primary voters as a whole.
Right.
And they're including people who are, you know, white suburban people who are doing fine.
Right.
And another study during the primaries, this was from 538, they found that the median income for Trump voters as a whole was lower than for Kasich, and it was slightly lower than for Kasich and Cruz. I don't remember where Rubio is, but it was higher than the median income for the supporters of both Democratic candidates. And I think that it is one way to explain this is that you visited communities that have been the most devastated.
Some of them, yeah. And, you know, they have a lot more reason to be aware of and angry at the impacts of free trade and growing inequality because they've been on the very, very short end of that stick often. And, you know, these people are very aware that it's not undocumented migrants who have caused the Alice Chalmers factory in Milwaukee to disappear, which used to employ, you know, 100,000 people. It was CEOs and their politicians pushing trade agreements and basically abandoning the American worker. And, you know, these other candidates that you described, it was very fascinating when I did attend these election events where the candidates spoke, they would always make these sort of offhanded remarks about they understand the anger of the working man and the men with the calloused hands, like Cruz loved that line. But then they would just stop and they would move on to something else. They never actually stopped and probed that anger. They never mentioned the words free trade because they were the ones who continue to back these sort of corporate Republican policies. And that's where Trump does stop and he does talk about it. And he does offer hard-hitting local examples of factories. And that is what, in my experience, really resonated with my subjects and what stopped them in their tracks with when he started to gain traction in this in the campaign and drew them to him.
Alex Zajcik, I believe we're out of time, but I really want to thank you for adding complexity to our often oversimplified view of the Trump supporter.
Oh, thank you very much. You're welcome.
Folks, that was Alex Zajcik. Check out his book. It is called The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. It's available from Skyhorse Hut Books. It is on my reading list. I will be reading it soon. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Christy Siegfried. Christy is the migration editor for IRIN, which is a news agency that covers humanitarian aid and development issues. And she joins us from just outside of Oxford in the UK. Christy, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you, Joshua. Nice to be here with you.
I'm so glad that you were able to make some time for me. Here in the U.S., the disaster unfolding in Central America, in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, has mostly been on Americans' radar because it sparked a significant flow of refugees, many of them children, which we kind of shamed ourselves by freaking out about. I wanted to have Christy on to talk about what's happening there, not through the prism of American interest per se. She's written a piece titled Gang Violence in Central America is a Humanitarian Crisis, and listeners can read it at irinnews.org. Christy, what are the Maras? Because they're often described as like street gangs. You use the word gangs in your title, but that seems to understate what they do and how much control they exert over large swaths of these countries.
Yeah, they're transnational gangs. A lot of them actually originated in the U.S., in L.A. And when people were deported back to Central America, they sort of restarted the gangs on their home turf. And they've really taken over to the point that there are certain parts of these cities where they are in control, basically, where many local authorities just wouldn't go. They have their territories. And if you're from a rival gang, you don't go into someone else's territory. They have a huge amount of control.
And I would just take a moment to pause and point out that this is, to some degree, and I don't want to overstate it, an unanticipated consequence of a policy that enjoys broad bipartisan support in the United States of deporting so-called criminal aliens. You know, we basically sent these street gangs that we had the government capacity, we had the capacity to keep in check into these back home to these fragile countries, and they have basically taken over certain areas of these countries in turn. Now, what are the governments doing to combat the Maras, or how is this a testament to how these states, to the degree that these are fragile states?
Yeah, yes, it is to a certain extent. I mean, these were countries that were already recovering from decades of civil war, so they had weak state institutions. They've tried various things, but basically quite a heavy-handed approach, law and order approach, which hasn't worked. We're seeing the results of that and the need really for outside actors to get involved.
And you quote the head of a Brazilian think tank who told you that within humanitarian circles, among the actors that do need to get involved, as you say, there's still a slow recognition of the scale and magnitude of the problem. Why is that? Why has there been a slow recognition of this problem, given the scale, the enormity of the problem? And I should point out that you write that the per capita death rate in these countries now rivals that of Syria.
That's right. I think it's El Salvador now, which has the highest homicide rate in the world, but Honduras and Guatemala aren't far behind. I think the reason it's taken so long is because it's not a classic conflict in the sense of Syria. It's not an armed conflict in the sense of a war. So it's not a natural disaster. Those are the kind of situations where aid agencies are used to getting involved, often working in kind of remote rural areas. They're not so used to working in cities where, you do have a government that's, somewhat functioning. So it means kind of changing their way of working. And, change is always hard to do. It takes time.
Yes, it is hard to do. And there's other factors, as you mentioned. So under international law, gang violence, it doesn't matter how severe its impact, it's not considered an armed conflict. How does that change the legal landscape for aid agencies that might want to help the populations in these countries?
Well, we have international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, which provide certain protections to aid agencies who are working in the context of armed conflicts. So, for example, you're not supposed to bomb hospitals. You're supposed to allow people like the Red Cross to go in and remove the injured, and that they have a certain level of impunity. And also, you would be able to negotiate with the different actors in a conflict to get the humanitarian access. And there's kind of principles in place to guide all that. That's not the case here because this isn't considered an armed conflict that's covered by international humanitarian law.
And you note in the piece that you could actually, theoretically at least, find yourself in legal hot water for even talking to the gangs to negotiate access to the areas that they control, right?
That's right. I mean, technically, it could be a criminal offense to be talking to someone who's a convicted killer and not to notify the police about their whereabouts. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't think that's actually happened, but in theory, it could. So,
and you can imagine how that would make international aid agencies wary to go in. You write that while the need for humanitarian aid to the victims of these gang wars is rising, the resources available to provide that aid are dwindling. What's going on in terms of the funding picture?
Well, over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, bilateral and multilateral aid to the entire region has dropped because most of those countries are now viewed as middle-income countries who've kind of recovered from periods of civil war. There's a perception that there's less need for aid. And in the case of Central America, I think it's felt that this is a problem that is kind of in the US's backyard and they should be taken care of. So there's not a huge amount of interest from donors in Europe, for example, to get involved. Although, as I mentioned in my piece, the one donor that is funding humanitarian responses is the European Union's humanitarian department, ECO.
And it seems like the U.S. has taken an increasing share of the burden of providing aid to these countries. Let me ask you this. Are we sponsoring the programs? Are we funding efforts that best fit the needs of these countries' populations? Or are we financing programs that are more targeted towards our own interests, which is tends to be stemming immigration, refugee flows, and of course, illegal drugs?
Well, to be fair, I think there's a bit of both. There is now some funding for violence prevention programs and development, economic development. You know, the reason people are leaving the region is not only because of gang violence. There's also, you know, obviously it's a complex set of reasons and partly they're economic. So, I mean, the Obama administration is funding a massive program. I think it's worth about $1 billion to, you know, promote development and violence prevention. And obviously an underlying reason for that is the asylum seekers who are arriving at the U.S. border.
What a mess. Christy, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for shining some light on this issue for us.
You're very welcome.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with an old interview with Paul Piff.
Oh, to the show. My next guest is someone whose research I've cited quite a bit over the past few years. Paul Piff is a social psychologist at UC Berkeley, and he's done a lot of research into the mindset of wealthy people. Paul, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on, Josh. It's really a pleasure.
So, for me, the context for your work actually comes from political scientists. Thomas Hayes is a scholar at Trinity University, and he recently published a study in the Political Science Quarterly, and he found that United States senators respond almost exclusively to the interests of their wealthiest constituents. He looked at 8 years of voting patterns, and he found that in some years they also were somewhat responsive to the middle class. In other years they weren't, and they were never responsive to the interests of the working poor. And this study confirmed what previous studies had found. Larry Bartell at Princeton came to the same conclusion in a 2005 study. So, Paul, that brings us to your research about who these wealthy constituents are that wield so much influence over our political system. Again, this is from my perspective, this is the key context. Now, you're an academic, but I'm not, so I can say in very plain language that what you found seems to be that they tend to be jerks. Not all of them, of course, but they're more likely than the average Joe to be jerks. So let's just dig into this a bit. First, tell us about empathy, about sensitivity to the suffering of others.
So, empathy is a broad psychological construct that refers to how able a person is mentally, psychologically, behaviorally, physiologically to relate to the mental states of others. And it's played a big role in our evolutionary history. It's played a big role to the emergence and evolution of human social groups. And it's really, really central to our survival. It's central to how a mother relates to the plight of her child, how siblings relate to one another. And it also, you know, it's a big variable that explains why people reach out across the oceans to save a leatherback turtle or dying individuals in an impoverished nation. So
Right. Empathy
is a really central thing. It's something we all do. And one of the things that I've gotten really interested in is studying how empathy and compassion and all of its behavioral components vary by a person's levels of wealth and status in society. And I wouldn't say that we've been finding that wealthy people are jerks or more jerk-like necessarily. Wealthy people do a lot of really great things for society, but one of the things that we've been documenting is that the higher up in the social ladder you are, the less able you are to relate to the plight of others lower than you in the socioeconomic hierarchy. And from that emerges a lot of, I think, somewhat pernicious, if you will, or social costly outcomes. Like reduced compassion, reduced generosity, reduced helping behavior. And we've been documenting these patterns across a whole slew of laboratory studies that we've been running over the last 7 years.
And I should just make it clear that when I said wealthy, you do use a kind of a broader measure of social status that includes the job status and et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think it was your most recent study that found the wealthy tend to be more likely to be to exhibit narcissistic traits. Can you unpack that a bit for us?
Yeah, so the question there was whether people who are wealthy, and sometimes we measure wealth using how educated, prestigious someone's job is and how wealthy they are, this sort of broad construct. And sometimes I just look at a person's levels of wealth, how much money they have, how much money they make. So it kind of depends on the project. And in this latest one, I measure wealth in a whole bunch of different ways and status in a whole bunch of different ways and generally find that wealthier, higher status individuals are more likely, I think somewhat surprisingly, to feel that they're more deserving of good things in life. Now, that may not be totally surprising, but there's a lot of rational economics that would say that it's actually the less privileged in society who don't have, who should feel that they're more deserving of things because they're the ones that don't have them in the first place.
Right.
We find the opposite. And it's that entitlement, that feeling that I deserve more than others among the wealthier that actually explains why they're more narcissistic. And we measure narcissism in a whole bunch of different ways. But narcissism just refers to the extent to which a person thinks that they're more important, more omnipotent, figure largely or figure larger in the world than other people around them.
And you also found that they're more likely to check themselves out in a mirror. Paul, any sense of the causal relationship here? Could it be that these traits are more likely to result in you having higher socioeconomic status rather than the kind of more intuitive explanation that wealth makes you more likely to feature these behaviors?
That's right. I'm a social scientist, and I'm really interested in the direction of these effects. What is it that's causing what? And, you know, for some people, it may not even matter. It may just matter that those who are the wealthier in society are more likely to exhibit certain traits than others. And that holds true independent of what variable is causing what. But because I'm a social scientist, I'm really interested in causality, as you, Josh, pointed to. And we've run a lot of different studies where we actually, while we can't manipulate people's actual wealth, I don't have billions of dollars to randomly assign people to different groups and then watch them 30 years later, we can and have devised certain psychological manipulations that can temporarily alter how much, for instance, you, Josh, think you have relative to other people. We've had people play these rigged games of Monopoly where they're the rich player or the poor player, and we've also devised a whole bunch of other kinds of really subtle manipulations where we temporarily make rich people feel poor or poor people feel rich. And the most, I think one of the really amazing lessons that we've learned is that even if you bring someone who's actually rich into the lab and temporarily make them feel poor, or bring someone who's poor and temporarily make them feel rich, you find the same patterns of behavior, which suggests that this isn't a characteristic of the wealthy at all. It's not as if wealthier individuals have these traits that necessarily make them behave these ways, but rather that the psychological experience of having more than others, and in many cases having so much more than others, that we see in society today, that really seems to be driving the psychological tendencies and patterns of behavior that we've been documenting.
That is absolutely fascinating. Folks, if you're tuning in, I'm speaking with UC Berkeley social psychologist Paul Piff. Paul, I lived in Germany for a while, and everyone there kind of agreed, it's almost like a running joke, that people who drive big, fancy cars tend to be more aggressive drivers. They're jerks. They drive like jerks. You actually have some scientific evidence to back up this kind of conventional wisdom. Can you tell us briefly about the crosswalk and intersection studies you conducted?
Yeah, so we ran those studies to sort of piggyback on a bunch of different laboratory studies that we'd done where we were looking at the relationship between a person's socioeconomic status, their levels of wealth, and how likely they were to break certain kinds of rules, something social psychologists refer to as unethical behavior or
right.
Unethical decision-making. And so we wanted to run some real-world extensions of this, and what we came up with was looking at the kind of car a person drives, because believe it or not, while there are exceptions, the kind of car you drive is hugely predictive of how much money you have. The correlation is very, very, very high. And so we ran a couple of studies where we looked at whether drivers of more expensive vehicles were more or less likely to, in one study, cut other cars off at a four-way intersection, or in a follow-up study, drive through a crosswalk without stopping for a pedestrian that we'd posed at that crosswalk waiting to cross. In California, that's really a ticketable offense. It's a violation of the law.
Yeah, in New York, it's mandatory. You have to drive through the crosswalk.
Perfect. That's what I've heard. And, yeah. And it's a reminder to really look both ways and then look both ways again before you even proceed to step off the sidewalk.
That's exactly right.
What we found here was that as the expensiveness of a vehicle increased, so the more expensive a person's vehicle was, the more likely they were to break the law by, for instance, driving through the crosswalk without stopping. And it was statistically significant. But not only that, the effects were really, really profound. In our low status category, none of the cars failed to stop. So all of our low status cars stopped for the pedestrian, let the pedestrian walk through. But that high status vehicle, that driver of the BMW or the Mercedes, they were just as likely to stop as they were to drive through. They were 50% their likelihood of driving through the crosswalk was 50%. So it was like a flip of the coin. So it was extremely significant, the differences that we saw between the high and low status categories.
I drive a 25-year-old Mustang with a bunch of rust spots in it, and I'm a very polite and cautious driver.
Well, then you'd fit right in. If only we'd had you included in our study.
Oh, yeah, the classic guy with a beater car that stops for everybody. Now, Paul, there's this in other experiments, you found a greater tendency to engage in a variety of other unethical behaviors, as you say. I want to ask you about a study you did with some colleagues from the University of Toronto, and one of the experiments yielded an almost onion-esque result, that the wealthy were more likely than others to take candy from a baby. Tell us a little bit about that.
It sounds like it's almost derivative from like a Simpsons episode
really
or something like that.
Mr. Burns stealing candy from a
baby.
Okay,
so it sounds funnier than it actually is.
Yes.
So there's a measure that's been used in the past to look at how entitled a person is. And we adapted that for this study. So basically, we didn't just invent this out of the blue for the sake of making headlines. This is sort of a standard measure that social psychologists have used in the past. But it was fairly simple. We introduced participants to a jar of candy that we said was reserved for children participating in a study in a developmental lab nearby. And then we simply tracked how much candy participants took for themselves. So sort of indirectly, the more participants took for themselves, the less candy they understood would be available for these children participating
right
in a lab nearby. And we found that in this case, we'd actually manipulated people's perceived levels of wealth. And people who felt wealthier took two times as much candy as participants who felt less well off. Again, pointing to this effect of feeling better off than someone else doesn't actually make you, we're finding, more compassionate, more empathic, and more likely to want to share resources with another person. It's the opposite. The more you feel you have, the more you want. And that's a really ironic effect. It's not as if you feel like you have more, your appetite for material resources is satisfied,
right,
and you're more likely to want to share resources with another person. It's almost like the more you have, the more appetitive, or the greater your appetite looms, the greater it becomes, and the more you're willing to do to satisfy that appetite.
That's a really fascinating finding. And you also found that they were more, that the wealthy or those with higher socioeconomic status were more likely to cheat in a contest to win a prize. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, I love that study. We had people play this, what we called a game of chance. They got on the computer and they're told, hey, it's your lucky day. You don't have to participate in all those boring psychological studies that you're used to. Today, you get to play a game. And in this game, the computer is going to virtually roll a die for you five times. And the higher your total is across these five rolls of the die, the better your chances are going to be to win this $50 cash prize. And because we can't track your roll, we need you to keep track of your total across all five rolls and report it at the end. But unbeknownst to participants, the game's actually rigged.
Right.
So they think the computer's rolling a die for them, but we've programmed the computer to roll the same score for everyone, totaling to 12. But by giving people the opportunity to report their score to us, we're giving them the opportunity to cheat. So any score that participants reported over 12, they're cheating,
right,
because it's impossible for them to have gotten that score over 12. And the higher your socioeconomic status was, the more likely you were to cheat. In fact, people at the top were cheating four times as much as people at the bottom, which is a really surprising effect. And that effect held when controlling for all sorts of other things, like how religious people are, their political orientation, how old they were. So there really does seem to be the specific effect associated with your position in society and how likely you are to kind of privilege your own self-interests above the interests of other people. There's kind of this greed is good ideology, if you will, that's more favored the more high you are in the socioeconomic ladder.
Do you remember what the highest score was?
Lots of people reported 30. reported the maximum. And how many of those people were people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder? Zero.
Zero. I mean, it would be statistically so unlikely to roll five sixes. Finally, Paul, before I let you go, is there any way to make self-centered, wealthy people more empathetic to the suffering of others?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the really hopeful lessons that we've learned from the work that we've done. So beyond just documenting these differences, we're really interested as social psychologists in examining the kinds of things that can be done to kind of increase empathy or increase compassion or increase generosity among those who are more privileged in society. And that's an important point because we know that inequality is on the rise and wealth is increasingly concentrated in the hands of a select group of individuals. So how do you get people who have those resources to be more willing to take on responsibility for the plight of others? And we've run a lot of different studies looking at, for instance, simple interventions that induce egalitarian values, that induce compassion. In one, we had participants watch a brief video about childhood poverty, and then an hour later looked at their levels of volunteerism. And even that quick video, that 46-second video about childhood poverty that reminded the wealthy about the needs of others in other countries and in their own, an hour later made them be just as charitable and just as helping, just as compassionate as their less wealthy counterparts, suggesting that really simple things like reminders of the needs of others can go a long way toward fracturing the kind of insular world that wealth affords you with and remind you of how important it is to try to help others when you can.
Paul Piff, I think we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
No, thank you, Josh. It's really been fun. Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like to thank Alex Zajcik and Christy Siegfried for joining me this week. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank Digby and Crooks and Liars for allowing me to host the show at their joints. And of course, I'd like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.